Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, April 7th, 2011. First, I want to make an announcement about some changes in agenda just for folks who are waiting around. We are going to carry over the work sessions on Senate Bill 83 and Senate Bill 805 to next Tuesday. Do I need to open those up and carry them over?
No, just need to announce it.
Okay, so just if anybody's here for Senate Bill 83 or Senate Bill 805, we're going to carry those over. We are also going to have a different agenda order. We're going to start with Senate Bill 924 because we have Senator Boquist here is going to introduce the bill. And then we will be doing Senate Bill 706 and then Senate Bill 743 last. So with that, we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 924. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You want Beth to open up here?
Yes, I'm sorry. Beth's going to do an introduction, and then we'll hand it over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 924 does a number of things related to wildlife penalties. I'm going to be discussing the Dash 3 amendment, which is in the packet in front of you. The Dash 3 directs the Fish and Wildlife Commission to revoke the licenses, tags, and permits when a person is convicted of a felony or Class A misdemeanor relating to the taking or sale of threatened or endangered species. The amendment replaces the original bill. We don't have fiscal or revenue statements yet on the Dash 3 amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, and welcome, Senator. And I was going to say, could you also provide a little bit of background, if you probably were going to, but since this is sort of revisiting an issue from last session, that'd be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Haas, Senator Thompson. I'm Senator Brian Boquist, Senate District 12, and I was actually, Madam Chair, looking through it. This is not my bill, just so you all know. I was trying to figure out, and I can't even find an original bill, so I don't know whose bill it was.
I think it's a committee bill.
Okay, so that's where it came from. No. It doesn't matter, Madam Chair. I'll just go on right here. This is...
No, you co-sponsored it with me.
Did I? Okay. That's why it's so old, Madam Chair. Colleagues, this is about a four-session-old bill. We've had, and what it addresses is egregious wildlife violations. And the issue boils down to this, and I'll explain to how we got to where we are. What we call an egregious violation is somebody goes out and, you know, and I don't know what the limit is. And the clam limit is, you know, 50. And they go out and take 1,000 clams and they know it. And that's an egregious violation. They go out and they take an endangered species, not once or twice, but do it 3 times and they know it. And what happens is in the process is that they get their wrist slapped. And so, how this kind of came to me, and interesting enough, and I guess I am a co-sponsor on it now that the chair mentioned that, is that the issue came back again early this session, and it was one of those issues that, unlike the other one you had, that I really had no, I guess you could say, commitment to. It's just that I had one side come in, which was from the animal side, we'll just say that, come in and make a presentation and a plea that this is an ongoing issue. You've heard this before in the previous committee. It hasn't gotten resolved, so on and so forth. And I said, well, I'll at least look at it. You know, you're all senators. You know how that goes. And within one day, the hunter side that came in that's paying all of their fees says, you know, this issue's still going on, and we're paying money, and we're losing money over here because it's not getting fixed. So I said, all right, look, since both sides are regulars here, for a better word, what I'll do is I'll try to get everybody together on this issue. Now, again, this is a four-session-old issue. And so what I did is I invited everybody, and I had a copy of an email passed out to me in the actual final draft that went downstairs that simplifies the language in the bill. This is pre-legislative council language, by the way. If you look at the cast of characters on the sent portion of the email that's into the public record, I invited everybody to come in, and I thought it was actually a novel concept because I invited them to come and meet in the Republican caucus room. I thought, well, I'll eliminate half of them because they won't come in. Actually, everybody did show up. Everybody that had a vested interest from the animal rights side, from the preservation side, from the hunting side, from the fishing side, all the way across the spectrum, everybody came together and sat down. And I basically said, look, we haven't made progress in four sessions. And so what I want to know is, here's a draft that was from the previous go-round. What do you want to do? What do you want to add? Everybody gets to add what they want to add. And we actually sent a series of emails out to everybody on both sides and said, you put in what you want, and let's put it all into this bill. Don't argue about it. Let's just get it all in one place. And then we'll sit down and we'll talk our way through each of these places, and we'll agree what stays in and what goes out. Now, Should I tell you it's a unanimous yes? No. What I can tell you is after sitting down and going through this entire process is everybody either got to the neutral position or the supporting position of how to address this issue. And so at that point we stopped, and to be quite frankly, the issue out there is in the application of the law. Sometimes district attorneys don't have the right information to be able to go forward, and sometimes when they present it and the judge adjudicates the decision, the judge, what many say is too lenient. So this also had another issue. So then we said, okay, we need to go look at what the judiciary is doing, have a chat with the judiciary, coordinate with the House. There were members of the House that were in this work group. So where we are right now and what we decided to do and how to proceed is that we came up with what items we agree upon. We sent it down to Legislative Council, and I've tried to read through the Legislative Council's deal, and good luck, Madam Chair and members. I do know that this sheet right here matches it, and it's the right way to say it, so I've got that down. And so we have this agreement between everybody else. What we'd like to do, and the various people will come up and probably tell you the good things about it and the things they really didn't necessarily like in it, but they're palatable with, or something that they really didn't like that wasn't in it but we couldn't agree upon, but this is the base document to go forward with. What we're trying to do is basically pass something out to set the record in the Senate so that we have a format to go for, and then we have a discussion piece in the House of Representatives. In addition to that, then we have a discussion piece to go back to the judiciary and say, here's the record, here's the problem that we've experienced, this is 4 sessions old, here's how we're going to try and fix this and walk down the road. And that's kind of where we are. After 4 sessions, again, I was amazed that everybody was civilized in the room, amazed that you had such a wide diversity in the room, and I greatly appreciate all the sides across the spectrum. I think in the future I might try that, or if it doesn't work that way, I might borrow the Democratic caucus room, and we'll go down there and see if that works the reverse terms. But it's a start, Madam Chair. It's actually a good piece of legislation and gets us going the right direction. I would urge your passage. There's a lot of people, I'm sure, that will come up and talk in length about the various portions and how we got to there, because it is a lot of concessions on both sides to make this possible. And I think Beth and Chair Dingfelter and Senator Haas, who have been here for 4 sessions, recognize that the cast of characters and friends of ours that are going to come on from both sides and testify this is going to be pretty amazing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. Any questions for the senator before we release him?
Yeah. Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, thanks for coming today. This is the first time that I've heard this, and I've looked at it and read. I just want to make sure. This is directed at somebody it's convicted of a felony or Class A misdemeanor, and that doesn't mean if you're a felony for some other reason you get your license revoked. That's if pertaining to if you committed one of these acts, or does that affect all felons and all Class A misdemeanors?
Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, my read and my recollection of all this is we're in the statutes, the game violation statutes within here. I know there'll be members from the District Attorney Association that's here that could give you exact detailed information. What's also important to note in here is that we took out those things that are small fines and those lower level items that are out here. The second thing that is in here is we left the ability for the court in those first time offenses that weren't egregious. Now, you go out and get 1,000 clams or you shoot 4 bald eagles in a row, that's egregious. You knew what you were doing. That wasn't a mistake. And so those things are still in here. But the portions in here in terms of, you forgot your hunting license, you got a citation for a vehicle thing or something like that, those things aren't in the matrix here. Again, what we're talking about is egregious offenses. Here's a good example for your district, Senator. They go out and they catch 3 7-foot sturgeons. Mm-hmm. They knew better. And then they say, whoa, I didn't know. And that's just not possible.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Senator, for your hard work on this. And believe me, I don't think you would have gotten any different result from the Democratic caucus room. Okay, Elizabeth Kushwar, is Elizabeth in the audience? I know you had to leave, so why don't you come up? And let's see. I guess we had some folks who wanted to come together. So let's call up. How about, is Tom Wolf here? No. Yep, Tom, why don't you come up? Okay, did they sign up? Okay. And Travis? Is Travis Williams here? Travis? Oh, Sue, you'll come up for that. Whoever. Yeah, I saw that they want to, you guys all want to come up together, so I'm calling people who aren't, say they want to come up together. Okay, go ahead, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'd like to thank Senator Boquist and Representative Krieger for inviting the DAs to the work group. We kind of came in late into the process. I think we were able to identify some issues that we had with the original bill and as to potential issues of constitutionality, and the bill as amended seems to allay all of our fears, and so we are in support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Did I don't know if you wanted to try to answer Senator Thompson's question.
Sure, Madam Chair. Did my question before was just this pertains to somebody that actually creates an offense, killing too many, or creates one of these things that qualifies for this. It doesn't affect somebody that gets a felony from something else and they lose their hunting license. For that, is that correct? I just want to make sure I'm reading this right.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you. Tom?
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf, representing the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 924, the -3 amendments. The main concern we have is, as many of you may or may not know, at one time the white sturgeon population found in the lower Columbia River was the largest white sturgeon population in the world. They estimated there was over 1 million white sturgeon in the lower Columbia. It was a huge population, as you can see from observing ODFW reports and other scientific reports. The population has dropped by quite a bit. And one of the concerns we have is poaching of over 7 feet or over breeders. A lot of times, because sturgeon live so long and they don't really get into reproductive mode till they get over 7 feet. So whenever somebody illegally takes an oversized sturgeon, they are eliminating a large breeder that will reproduce eggs for future generations. So Trout Unlimited has a great concern about that, about a magnificent cold water species and fish that is found in the lower Columbia and other tributaries and rivers in Oregon. Sturgeon are a magnificent fish, even though Trout Unlimited is a group that focuses on salmon and trout. Many of the members of TU, when they come out to visit this area, the fish they most want to fish for is sturgeon, because there's nothing more exciting than a 5 or 6 foot fish that will literally come out of the water and walk on top of the water trying to get around. It's a truly magnificent fish, both as a sports fishing for sports fishing purposes and as a part of our ecosystem. So we ask you to pass this bill. We think that it was done very well, and we think that a lot of groups were consulted. I have been involved in this penalties stuff for 4 or 5 years, and poaching is a major problem in Oregon, poaching both the fish and wildlife species, and it needs to be stopped. And I think this bill takes a good step towards answering a lot of people's questions, yet imposing what I consider severe fines. Maybe some way time down the road we can impose more severe, but this is a good first step. So I urge you to support Senate Bill 924-3 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Travis?
Senator Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Travis Williams, and I represent Willamette Riverkeeper. I wanted to echo Tom's comments about white sturgeon. I think we've seen evidence of some of that poaching that has gone on firsthand in my experience over the past decade on the Willamette and its tributaries. The other component of this is that my organization in particular, and I know others do, get a lot of people out on our river systems to look at wildlife and to view wildlife, especially birds of prey, but certainly other species. And there are pretty well documented instances of people taking birds of prey. And I think from what I've seen of this process, it makes a lot of sense to increase the level of penalty for people rather than a slap on the wrist, to really make it meaningful and to make it something that they know there will be significant repercussions if they take species illegally. So I will leave it at that. We are very supportive of Senate Bill 924. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for any of these folks? Okay. Thank you. All right. So Bob Salinger, Deborah Schaefer, and Candace Plant.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland. And with me today are our staff veterinarian, Deb Schaefer, and a volunteer who's been with us for over 20 years, Candy Plant, to give you a couple of different perspectives on this issue. We're here in strong support of the 924. We think it's a very good bill. We appreciate all the work that has gone into this bill. And this is a real problem in Oregon. Poaching, although for many of these species, for example, birds of prey, has been illegal for more than a century, continues to go on. Our rehab center at Audubon, which sees about 3,000 birds a year, sees an ongoing stream of illegally shot birds of prey. A recent study by ODF&W that was reported in the Oregonian confirmed that nearly one out of every two deer that are shot in Oregon may be poached. There's no excuse. We support all elements of this bill, but I'm going to focus in on birds of prey. There's no excuse for shooting a bird of prey. These birds are easily distinguishable from other species, and they've been protected for a long time. Anybody should know what one is and that you're not allowed to shoot it. These birds are some of our most charismatic wildlife species. They're found in all habitats in Oregon, including urban landscapes. For many, the sight of a peregrine falcon or a redtail flying overhead is an entry point into the world of conservation. A lot of the people that work with Audubon get involved originally because they're inspired by these species in particular. We started a raptor cam that focuses in on a downtown redtail nest with KGW. Last year, that site got over a million hits. People from all over the country were actually watching it. People are fascinated by these birds. Birding's one of the fastest pastimes growing pastimes in Oregon, and wildlife watching in Oregon, along with fishing and hunting activities, contributes more than $1 billion to our local economies. And wildlife-related equipment purchases contribute over another $1.5 billion to our economies. So it has a huge economic impact as well. In addition, we spent a huge amount of money in this state recovering raptor species and protecting habitat, so we have another investment there. Every year, between 1% and 2% of the birds that we see are illegally shot or otherwise harmed, deliberate, illegal, intentional acts. That may not sound like a whole lot, but we only see the tip of the iceberg. It's very, very rare that a bird that's shot out in the wild is actually going to be found, recovered, and brought into a facility like ours. And I know you have data from rehab centers across the state. I know they've been writing in. This is something that we're all seeing, no matter where you are in Oregon. It costs a lot to repair these birds when we get them in, and Deb's going to talk more about that. And I want to give you an idea of what some of these crimes look like, because it's not just somebody out there plinking a bird. We've had osprey, for example, literally shot off their nest while their young were left to die. While we were training peregrine volunteers to monitor peregrines, a species that we spent 40 years recovering, hundreds of millions of dollars, 60 volunteers coming up to donate their time to Audubon and the state, that very same week we had a peregrine shot out of the sky and left to die on the side of the road. It died in the box on the way to Audubon. A couple of years ago, many of you may have heard about the roller pigeon cases, where people that raised pigeons as a hobby were killing birds of prey. It was an organized effort in Oregon, Washington, and California. The federal authorities estimate they were killing 2,000 to 3,000 birds of prey a year. And they were doing it by shooting, baiting birds into glass panels, trying to get them to fly into glass panels that they would set up with bait behind them, clubbing the birds to death, poisoning them, and even one person bragged about killing them, trapping them, and then spraying them with a combination of bleach and ammonia. He sprayed in their eyes and their mouths. People are very rarely caught for these kinds of crimes, and when they are, we've been very disappointed that the courts have not levied strong penalties to deal with them. And I want to give you one example from those roller pigeon cases. I read it to you a couple of years ago, but I want to read it again because this is the mentality of some of the folks that do this kind of stuff. They were bragging about this on the internet on openly available websites, and they talked a lot about the fact that they wouldn't get caught, and if they did, it would just be a traffic fine level violation anyways. This is a quote. "I laughed and I laughed when I heard the story about them killing peregrine falcons that we raised and released from Audubon. Because of all the hard, painstaking measures to get these birds to adolescence and then have to someone simply take them out was simply bliss. Use the 3S system, shoot, shovel, and shut up." And these guys did get off with low penalties when they did get caught. So we believe this bill will increase the penalties, send a strong message to our communities, send a strong message to poachers, and also send a strong message to the courts that we want these crimes taken seriously. It's a way to protect our natural heritage, our community investments, and our local economies. So we strongly encourage you to pass 924.
Good afternoon, Senators. I'm Deborah Schaefer. I'm an Oregon licensed veterinarian that works at the Audubon Society of Portland. I've been there for 7 years. In the care center at Audubon, we treat over 3,000 wild animals per year and then respond to over 15,000 wildlife-related calls. We're open every day of the year, 365 days, and we're staffed by just two veterinarians and then about 80 volunteers. We also have several local veterinary clinics that donate their time to us, and we also work closely with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Oregon State Police, and other agencies. In the care center, we see a large array of injuries, but the most troubling are those that are intentionally caused by people, particularly the hawks, owls, falcons, eagles, the raptors that have been illegally shot. It's a horrible feeling to be holding one of these birds in our hand and then look in an x-ray and see that somebody's put a bullet into it. And unfortunately, this isn't rare. We do, as Bob said, see a steady stream of illegally shot birds, up to 1 to 2% of what we see per year in the care center. Just in the past several months, we've seen several hawks, falcons, an owl, and a bald eagle that came in shot. And this is just what we're seeing. It's the tip of the iceberg. Most of the birds illegally injured or killed are never found. And a lot of these birds don't survive their injuries even if they make it into the care center. Many come in dead or with injuries that we can't do much about and we have to euthanize. If they do recover, a lot of times they're in the care center for months and even over a year. So the recovery is expensive. Costs for an individual bird can run into thousands of dollars when you include the examinations, the x-rays, the surgeries, physical therapy, medications, food, caging. And again, they can be there for a long time before they're in a condition that we can get them back into the wild. And the only way we can afford to do this is with the dedicated team of volunteers that we have, donated medications and supplies, and also donated services by the local veterinary clinics. It's really a community effort to save these birds. So the point I want to make with you today is that treating the injuries caused by this type of illegal activity is very expensive and is only able to happen because so many people care about so many of these birds. And the penalties levied against people who intentionally harm these birds should be proportionate to the investment that our community is making to save them. It's deeply troubling to our community that while we are spending our time and extensive resources to save these birds, the people who commit these crimes are often getting off with minimal penalties. So we strongly support the Bill 924.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon, committee chairs and members of the committee. My name is Candace Plant, and I reside in the Charbonneau District of Wilsonville, Oregon. I am here today taking time off from work, driving from Portland during a very busy time for me, as I am employed as a tax accountant. The filing deadline is only 11 days away, and I work for a CPA firm in the Portland area. But I felt it was very important for me to be here today and to testify in support of this bill. I'm a businesswoman, and I recognize the incredible economic value that these birds bring to our state and our community. Bird watchers buy expensive cameras to photograph wildlife, they buy spotting scopes, and they spend money on trips to go birding in local areas and throughout our state. I have a group up at Audubon that I go birding with each month at one of Portland's area's many wildlife refuges. We are called the Oven Birds,
In addition to bird watching, we look for a restaurant in the area after our outing to eat lunch and to talk about the wonderful morning we had counting the different species of birds. I have been volunteering for the Audubon Society of Portland Wildlife Care Center for over 20 years. 4 years ago, I actually quit my full-time job at a CPA firm to work part-time so I could spend more volunteer hours up at Audubon. I have been averaging around 700 volunteer hours a year. That means that I have given up in wages $15,708 per year to volunteer those 700 hours up at Audubon. I volunteer a day each week at the Wildlife Care Center, which starts at 9 o'clock in the morning and sometimes ends at 8 o'clock in the evening. That equivalents to an 11-hour day, and I'm on my feet for most of that time. I also volunteer on other days of the week as I am an educational bird handler for 8 birds that were brought to the Wildlife Care Center, but because of their injuries or being kept illegally as a pet, they are not able to be released back in the wild. It is such an honor for me to take these educational birds to schools and to share them with the school children and teachers. I was at a school in the Cedar Mills area 2 years ago with Hazel, our northern spotted owl, to do a presentation for the first graders. I learned afterwards that when I entered the school with Hazel, who was in her carrier, that the school went into lockdown. I was so thrilled for Hazel and me to get that kind of reception. I have many times when handling one of our educational birds on the grounds up at Audubon, after talking to a family group about the natural history and the story of the educational bird that I'm handling, that we have been both asked to be included in a family picture. That is how special our visitors feel after seeing and hearing about one of our educational birds. I have also been part of Audubon Society's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Program, which started in the mid-90s at the Fremont Bridge. I can proudly say that because of me and other Audubon Society volunteers that spent countless hours each year from January through July monitoring the nest site for the safety of the baby peregrine falcons, that this year, the 50th baby peregrine falcon will be raised at that nest site on the Fremont Bridge. And now the peregrine falcons also have active nest sites and have had for the past several years on St. John's Bridge, the Markham Bridge, Interstate Bridge, and Abernathy Bridge in Oregon City. I am also proud to say that at the Fremont Bridge and Markham Bridge nest site, Audubon volunteers have shared with the City of Portland a chance to see these magnificent birds up close through a spotting scope and to hear their story on how they have recovered from being listed as endangered. All the work that myself and Audubon's 80 Wildlife Care Center volunteers are doing is for nothing if the state allows people to just go out and shoot these birds with virtually no repercussions. It is absolutely heartbreaking for me to hold a red-tailed hawk while it is being administered a lethal injection for euthanasia by our staff veterinarian because of a gunshot injury. But the really sad part about this is that the following day, one of my co-volunteers will possibly be repeating what I had done the prior day, also holding a raptor that has been shot and will have to be euthanized. The state of Oregon needs the countless hours that I and other volunteers spend to help the state achieve its conservation goals, but I'm worried that the state of Oregon will lose the efforts of the volunteers like me if our investment is not protected. It is an incredible thing to see a peregrine falcon or a bald eagle flying over downtown Portland. I am not speaking as a politician or a biologist or a corporate business owner, but I'm speaking as a dedicated volunteer who loves our state and asks that our state legislature please pass Senate Bill 924 and provide these birds with the protection they deserve.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the testimony. Any questions for any of these witnesses? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Maloney. Jim here. And I'm sort of assuming Dave Slover and Ron Kay, I think. Did you mean to sign up for the other bill? Okay. Not that. Scott Beckstead, is Scott here? And then Al Elkins. So you can come up, please. Let me go ahead and write that on the other bill. Okay. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senators.
My name is Jim Maloney. I serve on the executive board for Lane County Audubon Society, one of a dozen local Audubon chapters in the state of Oregon. Lane County Audubon is a nonprofit, fully volunteer organization dedicated to the conservation of birds. And we have over 1,560 member households, with most of them in the Eugene Springfield area, but we have members all the way from the coast up to the crest of the Cascades. I'm here today to express Lane County Audubon's strong support for Senate Bill 924. Like Portland Audubon, our chapter is also deeply concerned about the poaching in Oregon. This bill will help to ensure that when people deliberately kill birds of prey, appropriate penalties are administered by the courts. It requires that people intentionally killing birds of prey that they receive a penalty not less than half the maximum allowed by the law. On Audubon field trips that I lead, I notice that birds of prey hold a fascination for almost all people, young and old, novice to expert. For many people, birds of prey are their first connection to conservation. Many of our members are inspired to join and become involved in protecting and restoring habitats all across the state. We have members that go all the way over to Heart Mountain Refuge to pull old barbed wire fences so they don't catch owls and other birds of prey over there. In these efforts, these members also contribute to the state's tourism and recreation economies. Today, our members and those of other Audubon groups donate thousands of hours each year working on projects to restore habitats by removing abandoned barbed wire, like I mentioned, removing invasive species, and providing nest boxes and platforms to improve the chances for survival of these birds. After all these efforts, we are deeply troubled by the wanton killing of these birds. You folks may recall winter of 2005-2006, this was covered in most of the newspapers in the state, we had one of those remarkable outbreaks of snowy owls coming down from the Arctic to Oregon. A lot of them ended up along the coast. They got as far as Coos Bay down there. Over a few weeks, as bird enthusiasts and families flocked to the coast to see such a remarkable animal, one or more individuals decided that shooting at them was fun or interesting. At least two of the birds were killed, and I don't think anyone was ever apprehended. We are further concerned that when these crimes do occur, even when the perpetrator is identified, they often get off with very light sentences. It's important to our members and anyone else to know that their investments in protecting and restoring raptor populations will be worthwhile, that when someone intentionally kills one of these birds, the crime will be treated with the severity that it deserves. We strongly encourage you to pass Senate Bill 924 and send that strong message. Thank you.
Thank you. Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Scott Beckstead, Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States, resident of Sutherland in North Douglas County, here today in support of Senate Bill 924. At least as many animals are illegally killed in Oregon as are legally taken, and for that reason, the Humane Society of the United States views poaching as an important animal welfare issue. We support Senate Bill 924. We view it as an important first step in giving Oregon's wildlife the protection that they need. It's also an important additional tool for law enforcement to have the tools that they need to protect Oregon's wildlife. I just want to say that we appreciate being invited to the process and are excited to be part of the solution. Thank you.
Thank you. Al?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. Just quickly, I'd like to thank Senator Boquist and the Representative Krieger for working with this group. We've been meeting for about 2 years now, the last 3 months here in the building, we support the Dash 3s and support Senate Bill 924 and the intent that it brings to helping protect the wildlife in Oregon. And we appreciate being here today. And I'm sorry, I've got the Capitol Cub.
Just stay on that side and you'll be okay.
Plague. And
you may want to move over a little bit.
Can't talk very well.
Any questions for anybody? Yes, Senator Thompson?
Madam Chair, thank you. On part of the Dash 3, it talks about taking a bull elk or buck deer with at least blank points on one antler.
Right.
Was there ever a number or is it just points?
No, Senator Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, we are continually working on this amendment with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and with Sue, and our suggestion from OHA is that we use the language that's already in 496705, which outlines the points and the price, the value of all of those critters. So that's where we are right now. I don't know what we'll end up with, but that's where we are.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Anybody else would like to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 924. And we're going to open up an informational meeting on Senate Bill 706. And Beth, do you want to just say what the bill does? And John will come up. And Lee, do you want to come up with him? Or no? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 706 directs the Public Utility Commission to establish parameters for energy studies to be performed by public utilities. It directs the utilities to complete the energy studies by June 30, 2012, and PUC to report back to the legislature the results of those studies by January 2, 2014.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Savage. I'm with the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I have a few slides as soon as I can figure out how to work these.
There you go.
I'm going to cover two things in my testimony. I'm going to talk about the carbon reduction planning and analysis that the utilities are doing today as a prelude. Then I'm going to talk about Senate Bill 706, what it does and how it differs. So first, as way of background, we regulate three private electric utilities, PGE, Pacific, and Idaho Power, that serve about 75% of Oregon's households and businesses. We also regulate three natural gas utilities, Northwest Natural, Cascade, and Avista, that supply all the natural gas in Oregon. So as a starting point for any planning that is done is state and federal law frames what resources utilities can and can't develop to meet their customer needs. So, for example, we can't build a nuclear power plant in the state of Oregon until a permanent repository is up and running. Hydropower once accounted for about 60% of our electricity supplies, but we've cut generation to save salmon runs, and most sites now are off limits to new development. Oregon utilities cannot build or buy from new coal plants in Oregon. Under our renewable portfolio standard, PGE and PacifiCorp must meet 25% of their loads with renewable generation by 2025, and they now must comply with a solar photovoltaic standard that for systems greater than 500 kilowatts. And for conservation, PGE and Pacific customers pay a 3% charge on their bills that goes for conservation, renewables, and low-income energy programs. And utilities must supplement the 3% charge with additional funding to capture all cost-effective conservation. Built into state law are explicit targets greenhouse gas emission. Those targets are to reduce 10% below 1990 levels by 2020 and 75% below 1990 levels by 2050. So this slide shows sort of the scope of our authority, which I think is important for determining what we can and can't do. So our general authority, sort of our specific authorities derived from our general authorities to ensure safe and reliable service at just and reasonable rates. We cannot tell a utility what resources to build or buy. That's their decision. What we can determine is what cost we incorporate into rates for those decisions. We give guidance to the utilities on what investments appear to be prudent through their resource plans. Our focus is on the dollar cost incurred by the utility and its customers. So at the planning stages, because utility investments are so long-lived, we consider an array of future financial costs, including the potential cost of future carbon regulation. What we can't do is consider the social and environmental costs of utility investments unless those costs translate into dollar costs to the utility, such as through regulatory action. So we rely on comprehensive utility planning to determine the best course of action to meet customer needs reliably and affordably and achieve legislative directives. Every 2 to 3 years, our utilities must prepare 20-year resource plans. These plans govern when and what kind of resources are developed to meet customer needs at the lowest cost and risk. That's our goal. Utilities must consider all resource options on an equal footing, including energy conservation. And our review of the plans is rigorous, and we acknowledge or don't acknowledge that the actions that they're proposing is prudent. Since 1993, we've required our utilities to take into account the financial risk of future carbon dioxide regulation. They must include cost adders in their cost estimates of power plants that emit carbon dioxide, such as coal plants and natural gas-fired power plants. For example, PGE, in its most recent plan, assumed a base case value of $30 per ton of carbon dioxide emissions and has run scenarios assuming up to $65 per ton of emissions. And we also require the utilities to prepare plans to meet Oregon's carbon emission targets for 2020 and beyond. So let me turn to Senate Bill 101, and this was a bill that was passed last session. It requires the Commission to prepare a report every 2 years on the rate impacts of having the regulated utilities achieve two carbon emission reduction targets. One is to reduce emissions 10% below 1990 levels by 2020, and the other is to reduce emissions 15% below 2005 levels by 2020. We issued our first report in November. The utilities identified changes to their mix of resources that would result in meeting the targets, showing the results for the electric utilities of meeting the more stringent target of reducing emissions by 10% from 1990 levels by 2020. To meet the target, PGE would have to reduce emissions by an estimated 54% below its base case. For Pacific Core, it would be 31% below its base case, and Idaho Power, an estimated 16%. Corresponding rate impacts of 38% for PGE, 20% for Pacific, and 3% for Idaho Power. Finally, Senate Bill 706, what it does and how it differs. Senate Bill 706 would require our regulated utilities to conduct analyses of targets and strategies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that the Commission would specify through an open public process, and then the utilities would determine the impact on costs and rates and reliability of each of the scenarios that we asked them to study. We would synthesize those studies, and then we would prepare a report to the 2013 legislature. We would work closely with all parties. Now, let me go back. Don't have that. There. We would be working closely with all parties in this public process to set all the parameters for these studies. So this, we'd specify what scenarios that they would analyze. We would identify the measures available for reducing emissions, and we'd identify all the key policy assumptions. My final slide sort of explains to me how Senate Bill 706 is different than what we're doing today, and I think it's in four fundamental ways. One, it would expand on the number of types of scenarios that we would analyze. Two, it would allow us to look at coordinated solutions across all utilities rather than utility by utility. Right now, when we're setting targets, we're looking at each utility and what each utility must do to achieve those targets. Three, we would look at strategies to reduce emissions from direct use of natural gas in homes and businesses. And last, it would allow us to examine new strategies such as fuel switching from transportation fuel oil or home heating oil use to electricity and natural gas. So that concludes my testimony, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you, John. And I should say that I had asked you to come because there were some questions about this bill and if it was needed. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you is how do you currently account for carbon impacts in rates? So that was something that I wasn't clear from your slides. And also, does the PUC have a role in integrating carbon reduction in Oregon?
Let me try the – I'm sorry, I missed
– So we'll do the first one.
Yeah, I missed the
second. How do you currently account for potential carbon impacts in rates?
We account for carbon impacts in rates, Madam Chair, indirectly through accounting for carbon impacts in utility investments. So when we're looking at, when I'm going back to this integrated resource plans, the plans that the utilities bring forth to us and how they're going to meet customer needs over the next 2 to 20 years, they have to include in those what are called action plans. And those action plans identify very specific actions that they're going to take. And we acknowledge or don't acknowledge those actions. And when they come forth and they want to make those investments, and then at that point, if we acknowledge those, we're signaling to them, based on what we know now, these appear to be very smart things to do, which gives them some kind of assurance when they are seeking rate recovery that they're going to get it. So to make a long story short, the influence of our look at carbon is at the is when we're looking at what actions they should be taking, given uncertainty about the future or the potential for future carbon regulation. But I can't say directly, I can identify inner rates, that this portion of rates is due to carbon regulation or potential future carbon regulation. So it's indirect.
Well, you may have indirectly answered my next question, was whether the PUC, you have a role in integrating carbon reduction in Oregon. And the question was how do you do that through the IRP process?
The way that I was, Madam Chair, the way I was describing is we take into account the future financial sort of risks associated to the utilities. Again, its effect it's on the margin is on the investments that the utilities would be making. We would be taking that into account as one of the risks of certain types of investments other than compared to other types of investments.
Okay. So I'm going to see if there's other questions. I have a couple more.
Yeah, I have one.
Okay.
In the bill itself, it says on line 21, scenarios that require public utilities to determine the maximum amount of greenhouse gas emissions reductions that can be achieved without exceeding a specified rate impact. Could you define a specified rate impact?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, so this type of scenario would be say, let's cap any impacts to three, that rates could go no higher than 3% than what they are today, say, for example. So we're going to start that with that as our cap. And then the question is how much, given that rate cap, how much carbon emission reduction could occur? And so we'd plan. So in a sense, that would be a constraint, and then we would plan to reduce carbon emissions within that constraint. So that's, I don't know, I hope that explains that.
One other. Thank you, sir. This bill is an entire new set of studies. Do we need it? And if we do have it, how is it going to help the legislature plan for anything in the future?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think ultimately you're going to have to decide whether you need it. But let me explain. Let me explain what I think is what this bill does. Is saying is that we would look at a wide variety of futures, and we'd be able to tell you, depending on what you want to accomplish, what's it going to cost the state. You know, what we would be providing you would be information, and then it's a question of how that information would be used for future legislation.
Well, and I'm going to follow up to his question, which is, you know, whether you can determine how to reduce emissions on a least cost, least risk basis without a policy set by the legislature. So do you have the authority to do that under your existing authority?
We cannot set a carbon budget. Only the legislative, Madam Chair, you tell us the carbon budget, we would, through our planning, would be able to figure out the least cost, least risk way of meeting that carbon budget.
But you would need that direction from the legislature.
From the legislature.
Okay, there you go. At least we're on the same line reading or questioning.
Then the one thing I'd like to ask then, I noticed on one of your slides that you said that it would require PG to have a 38% rate increase. Do you have an idea what financially this is going to cost Oregonians if we attempt to implement any of this plan?
That would be, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that would be, depending on what scenarios, and we'd be looking at, probably looking at, if we did this, I would assume that we'd be looking at different targets, and that we would be determining what those cost impacts would be for each of the different targets. This particular target is a fairly stringent target of saying that we're going to reduce emissions 10% below 1990 levels by 2020. One of the reasons PGE is particularly hard hit by this is Trojan Nuclear Power Plant was operating in 1990, a carbon-free resource. It was a huge source of supply. It no longer is operating. It has been substituted with fossil fuel-emitting power plants. That's why if you change the base date, you know, from 1990 to 2005, the hit on PGE is significantly different, for example.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I have one last one for you, John, because I think this is very helpful. Why do you think it's important that the utilities do greenhouse gas planning? And we're not getting the full picture now. What I heard you say is you're doing it also by utility, not a comprehensive look at by the entire sector.
Yeah, Madam Chair, is if there is going to be carbon regulation, and this is, to me, one of the greatest uncertainties, I can tell you that we're working with and our utilities working with is what's the form nature of carbon regulation? When will it occur? When won't we have to anticipate it, but we don't, you know, it puts us in a very difficult spot. If we're doing it, the thing about a coordinated across utilities is that we would, it may prove out that rather than siloing it, where you're looking at each one is having to meet a very specific target, it may be cheaper, you know, if in a coordinated fashion, for example. For, you know, and I'll use the transportation fuels. It may be cheaper to make investments in which case we're using alternatives to transportation fuels using electricity and natural gas than other kinds of measures that the utilities would be taking. If we're just looking within the context of their utility business, for example.
I have a question.
Yep.
Is this bill a lead-up to cap and trade?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, this is I don't believe it is. I mean, I think this is a reporting bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, John. I appreciate
welcome.
It. All right. I don't think there's any other questions. So with that, we will close the informational session on Senate Bill 706. And we will open up our last public hearing on Senate Bill 743. Beth?
Members, Senate Bill 743 would prohibit the operation of a motorboat in excess of 5 miles per hour on the Willamette River from the north tip of the Ross Island to the north tip of the East Island and Holgate Channel. It sets the penalty for violations. There's no revenue impact, and we have not received a fiscal impact statement yet.
Okay. So we have on the line.
Do you want to transfer?
Yeah. Trey Karskadden. I can never, ever say his name right, who couldn't be here today in person, but he submitted written testimony, and he asked if he can call in. Trey was the chair of the State Marine Board at the time when this decision was made, and he very much wanted to introduce the discussion here today. So, Trey?
Yes, Chair Dinkfelder.
Hey, welcome. Boy, and we're right on time. I said around 4 o'clock, so pretty amazing. Thank you so much. I just introduced you. We do have your written testimony, and I said that unfortunately you couldn't be here in person, but we wanted to. Nobody else has testified yet. We wanted to have you do the overview and introduction, provide background on how this came to be and your observations as chair of the Marine Board when this decision was made. Thank you, Trey.
I'm happy to do that, Chair.
And can you just state your name again for the record?
You bet. Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Trey Karskadden. I'm a resident of Tualatin, and I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 743.
Great. Thank you.
And as I've indicated in my written testimony, I serve on the Oregon State Marine Board. I'm just finishing up my second four-year term. I term out in June for... about half of the 2 years, well, a little more than half of 2 years involved with this specific issue, I served as chair. And we gave this about a two-year look through a number of processes, which are detailed in my written testimony. And certainly, if you have any questions related to that, I'm more than happy to answer. And I'll be relatively brief, Chair, and members of the committee, and then certainly am eager to answer any specific questions that you have. But just as quick background, I believe I have expert-level knowledge and background related to this issue. Not only did I immerse myself in it, participate in a six-session facilitated work group, but I can't tell you how many pages of written testimony I reviewed, literally hundreds of public comments related to this over several hearings that we participated in, considerable interaction within the board and with board staff on this, okay, trying to find an answer. This wasn't our first trip to the rodeo dealing with no wake zones. We also spent quite a bit of time above Willamette Falls dealing with the Newburgh Channel issue, which was instrumental in helping me formulate my thinking and policy strategy related to Holgate Channel. So that's just as quick background. And I want to also take a moment to commend Randy Henry, the board's policy director, who really put a lot of effort into finding a compromise position on this, and where we settled, I think, at the at the end of this. However, my position and my opinion differs from staff recommendation and really supports the initial petition that was given to us to review, and also was supported by the City of Portland, which calls for the entire length, mile and a half length, Fallgate Channel to be a no wake zone. And it's almost a little bit difficult to believe that a mile and a half of water can generate so much controversy and acrimony, but it did. And consumed, I can't tell you how many staff and board member hours. But as I indicate in the testimony, and I gave some very specific reasoning, that where I ended up as supporting the no-wake position really was the product of decades of use of that area. I'm a power boater myself. I also own a non-motorized craft, and that's where I grew up running. That is my home water. I know that Senator Olson can appreciate what that means, particularly as a bass fisherman spending countless hours over specific sections of water, and that's one that I've spent almost a lifetime in and around. So given that, what I was found particularly compelling was on repeated trips through the summer months, in peak usage times in the morning. And I gave one anecdotal item there with KGW News. I was shooting a boating piece with Grant McComey there, and the literally platoons of non-motorized craft that would launch at Willamette Park, and which is across the river from this stretch of water, right across the river from Ross Island, and also just upriver from this channel is another launch site. At Selwood Park, and just below it is another launch site. And literally the platoons of non-motorized craft that would be on the water every morning and using this stretch of water. And I was particularly struck by the number of kids that were using it. That was probably the single most compelling thing I witnessed. Was I could kind of see myself as I started as a boater, as a non-motorized boater, and evolved into a boater, and kind of wondering, where these kids can go and have a special place, as well as the non-motorized boaters have a special place. I never really saw this as one group taking away from another, or the motorized community losing a stretch of water. I looked at it as an opportunity for the City of Portland to have a special place that they can promote. It would be very unique. I believe one of, if not one of few, the only one that I'm aware of in the lower 48 that would be in a major metropolitan area designated as a non-motorized boating area that would inspire commerce. There are two large rental operations that are doing several thousand rentals through the summer, as well as roughly 1,300 dragon boaters that are involved. Then you have the recreational kayakers, you have Olympic-class rowers, all of them using this stretch of water, as well as the main, the main Willamette as well. But it really comes down fundamentally, do we want to do something special, something unique, something that's uniquely Portland, that we can create a haven for these non-motorized boaters? And at the end of the discussion, I thought that that was the right direction to go. And in fact, in making that decision, I would restrict my own use as a power boater on that stretch of water. And I think it's good to share just one quick, I think when we're dealing with these policy issues, that every so often, at least in my experience, there's going to be one piece of testimony above and beyond all others that kind of jumps out at you and really makes an impression. And let me share just one very quick anecdotal piece that in the last hearing I was engaged in that was shared with us. And this gentleman, who I hadn't seen at any of the other hearings, from Tiger, he said, imagine driving down Broadway in downtown Portland. And now imagine the cars are going every which way with no lanes. There's no speed limit. Some are going fast. Some are big. Others are small. Some are going slow. Now imagine that none of them have brakes. That's what's happening at Holyoke Channel. And, it's being used, it's a very confined body of water. The nature of the wakeboard boats in particular is, by their design, to create a large wake that is really an incompatible use with the non-motorized craft that are using the area. That's and that's my strong opinion on that, and that's why I also took by the decision at Newburgh Pool. When you have a confined body of water like that, a relatively narrow body of water, as I know that Senator Olson is aware of, federal law is very clear that boaters are responsible for their wakes. Well, in the absence of any real enforcement there, and frankly, it's not that they won't enforce it, it's that Multnomah County has a large enforcement area. I think there have been instances of bad behavior, and that just given this narrow stretch of water, the use application is incompatible between motorized and non-motorized, particularly where large wakes are the result of the motorized boating activity. So, I'll finish by saying that I think that where I was left is that the citizens of Portland, the kids, the families, the dragon boaters, the rowers, the kayakers, the rental operations and canoeists fundamentally should have a place they can call their own and enjoy the tranquility and the safety of their boating experience in Portland. I think the perfect place for that haven is Holgate Channel. And for that reason, I support Senate Bill 743.
Okay. Thank you, Trey. Let's see if there's any questions, Trey, before we let you go back to your business. Do you have a question?
I do.
Okay. And it's Senator Olson. I'll just ask you if you will identify yourself. So
Trey, Senator Olson, how you doing, buddy?
Very well. Thank you, Senator.
Good, good. Hey, a couple questions for you. The Marine Board that you sat on was tasked to determine whether the Holgate Channel should be non-motorized, or should I correct that to say no-wake zone? Is that correct?
That's correct. No wake zone.
And how many hearings did you have on that, and how many votes did you take on that?
We had, I think it was three hearings. It may have been four, but three that I specifically remember. The first hearing resulted in a 2-3 vote that against the petition, which called for a no wake zone, and also a kind of a 50-50 split of the channel. The second, and I was chair for that, the second one designated the lagoon as a no-wake zone, and the third one resulted in a 3-2 vote that supported, it was about a two-thirds area being designated no-wake. And the reason that I elected and pushed to have this looked at wasn't a personal agenda on my part, Senator. It was a we hadn't had much time with the issue, and it was a difficult issue. We hadn't had a lot of time to really study this and spend time, and people, there were a lot of people engaged, and I hadn't felt like they'd really gotten a fair shake in the process. So as a result of that, we engaged a facilitated process that would span six meetings in about, 7 or 8 months, that we had stakeholder representation, and as I recall, there's about 10 stakeholders at the table, might have been 12. I made every meeting, and the goal was to see where we could agree, and we knew where we could do what we disagreed on, but see if there was areas of agreement, and there was some movement, by both sides, and it was clear to me at the end of the discussion that there was willingness on the part of motorized voters to do something. But certainly not restrict their primary use in the main area, but maybe designate some areas of the channel for non-motorized, primarily on the sides of the channels, and certainly on the non-motorized side, maybe not take the whole bite of the pie, but a bite of it. There were those on either side, as there are on these issues, as you well know, that were pretty dug in, and. But again, I ended up where I did because I saw kind of a long-term vision, both in terms of economics, as well as just the sheer numbers of people that were using it, that we could provide this haven.
Follow up. How many voters do you think use that as a ski haven to get out of that? You know, as you and I both know, on the west side of the river there, it's treacherous to maneuver your boat in the summertime. How many folks go in there and use that to water ski?
You know, that was really hard to determine. I made repeated trips there, and as you know, I spent a lot of time back there, Senator, boating and fishing. And over the last couple of years, most of that time was spent just observing. I went in with several different groups. I went in on my own. I went in with news crews to look at it. And frankly, I saw very limited powerboat use. My understanding is that primarily occurs, on the weekends and during late morning through the afternoon and early evening hours. But at the time that use is occurring, it's everybody's using it, and it's just I didn't quite buy the safety the level of safety concerns. But I think that you have it's really incompatible boating uses in a very confined area in the most popular boating destination in the state, which is the city of Portland going into the Columbia River. So by its very nature, you're going to have congestion issues really going from the last week of June into September. And we did discuss on the board, so kind of seasonal restrictions and that kind of stuff, but you get into real enforcement issues and difficulties. It seemed to me, if we're gonna do something, we just need to do it and make the rule.
One follow up question. I have one question more for you, Trey. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. The concern that bothers me is we spent a considerable amount of time and money tasking the Marine Board to do this this test or this this course of action that we're looking at, and you said it was that you didn't have much time and it was a very difficult issue, and now you're asking this legislative body to have less time and less time to consider the difficult issue and make a decision that the Marine Board had already come to, and you want us to kind of usurp their authority. Is this to me seems to be like it ought to go back to the Marine Board for further discussion instead of come to us as a bill. Good. What do you think about that?
I understand your concern, and I guess my thinking I don't know that my position was really out front ever in the discussions, and it would have been good, and maybe continuing part of the discussion. But I think it's good legislation. I think that the fact that we can create a very special place that's going to have strong economic benefit and enormously popular. I see the numbers of people using that area exploding in terms of non-motorized boats. I see that as a real, and we never really talked about that. What we were really boxed into was this whole, and as you know, because of the nature of the meeting laws, and our ability as a board to talk among ourselves, kind of off the record, is pretty limited. It's difficult to work through these things and kind of talk about all the broader global things. It would have been good, to have more interaction with the city of Portland. But it was clear in my communication I did have with the city, my outreach to the city, but that was part of their vision too. And I think there's times when these commissions work really well, and I think and that's because we've been extended that authority by the legislature to make rules. And I think there's times when legislature's got to step in and say, you guys, we understand the political difficulties associated with this issue. We understand where you're at, but we want to take more aggressive action. And I think this is a case of that, frankly, where some legislative support and legislative guidance is needed to fix this issue.
Okay. Any other questions for Trey? Trey, I just have one last question for you, and thank you again for your years of service. I know that you don't get paid beyond these boards and commissions, and we certainly appreciate all the time and effort that you volunteered. How many other areas in the state are designated no wake?
I I couldn't even venture a guess. There are several. There are at least dozens that are no wake zones.
Okay, we have the director here, so I may ask him that when he comes up later. And I just want to say thank you for taking the time. I know you're out of town on business, and really appreciate you calling in and for submitting testimony on this.
Thank you so much. I'll look forward to the result.
Okay. Thanks
and
so much.
If I could be a further service, Chair and members of the committee, please let me know. I'm happy to participate.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Trey. We're gonna sign out. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Before I call up, and I'm going to call up Jean, and I can't read your name, Quincy, and Andy Meyer. I just want to mention, why don't you go ahead and come up? I wanted to mention that we have testimony submitted from the Marine Board, and I will have them come up at the end because there will be some questions that I'll probably have them answer. So with that, if you can state your name for the record, whoever wants to go first. Yep.
Good afternoon, Senator Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Jean Quincy. Thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 743. I am a member of Wasabi Paddling Club in Portland, Oregon. We have 350 members within our club, and I'm also a private non-motorized boat owner. The Holgate Channel has a traffic control and safety problem. When traffic is light, there's little conflict. When traffic is heavy, on summer weeknights, weekends, conflict ensues, and safety for all watercraft operators becomes compromised. In 1995, in the Recreational Boating Management Plan for the Portland Metropolitan Waterways, a report to OSMB, wakes in the Holgate Slough were noted to be a problem. The recommendation of the committee to address these issues included information distribution and education. In 2006, 11 years later, in the Water Recreation Report and Recommendations, it was noted that the Holgate Slough was still a conflict area. Suggestions for improvement included signage and education. In 2011, 16 years later, after recognizing that prior information dispersal, education, and signage campaigns had not had the desired impact of mitigating user conflict, Oregon State Marine Board added to 250-020-0280 a slow no-wake zone in the southern end of the Holgate Channel. The OSMB ruling, if enforced, will protect watercraft users, both motorized and non-motorized, in the least safe area of the channel. This is the area near the mouth of the lagoon where, during low water, the channel becomes narrow. This area is adjacent to a blind curve and to the mouth of the lagoon where watercraft, including commercial barges, motorized and non-motorized, make directional changes, often crossing paths and creating dangerous situations. However, the OSMB ruling does not address the north end of the Holgate Channel, as does 743. Although wider, the north end, with more turning radius available for all watercraft, during low water times, the north end of the channel should also be considered a safety corridor. Non-motorized craft are often swamped, overturned, and are harassed by motorized boaters who are out of sight of enforcement. Speed limits by motorized craft often exceed reasonable safety limits. Coupled with the fact that the north end of the channel is the area the Ross Island Sand and Gravel Barge operates in, it is an area where all users need to take extra care to watch speed and be safe. Bill 743 would help ensure safety in the north end of the channel in addition to the south end. And aside from the safety issues, I would echo a lot of what Trey mentioned in regards to the unique positioning of the Holgate Channel within the downtown Portland area. There's many boathouses and paddling clubs located nearby that provide non-motorized users access to an area that is being with the parks taking over a portion of the land and putting investment into redoing that area. It's got the potential to be a jewel in downtown Portland. And I urge that the passage of this occur.
Thank you. Yep.
Hello, my name is Andy Meyer. I'm representing the Columbia River Yachting Association. We represent about 23 yachting clubs in the Portland and Columbia River area and about a couple thousand members. I was on the committee that Trey was talking about, the 10 members and the six meetings that we had. And at the end of that meeting, there were some votes and some resolutions. Those particular items haven't had a chance to even take place yet. I mean, we had the meetings last summer. There was a terrible child loss situation in all the sheriff's patrols, and everything had to be used for that in the Portland area. So there was no chance for the sheriff's patrol to even do any checking of that channel, the Holgate channel. A lot of the recommendations none of the recommendations have been implemented yet. Since that, the meetings that we had, as Trey mentioned, there was another meeting of the Marine Board, and they voted on the southern end of the Holgate channel to be made awake. That only leaves the northern part of the channel for power boaters to have any kind of recreational activity there, other than going into the lagoon and anchoring. If water skiers and other power boaters are not allowed to use that area, they will have to go out in the main channel. The main channel is, where all commercial craft and people are going fast. If you're learning to water ski, or tubing or anything like that, and have a problem out there in the main channel, the chances of somebody getting seriously hurt are much greater. We feel that this process has gone 2 years, as Trey said, and come to an agreement. We've come to some things have been done to change the Multnomah Channel. Obviously, the lagoon is now no wake, and the southern end of the island is now no wake. It hasn't had a chance to even be implemented yet this season. Last season, again, it happened in the middle, so there was no time for anything to be checked to see if the agreed upon things that we were going to do would work. So now we're trying to change even more and make the whole thing.
So, sir, can I ask you to wrap up? I've got four more people, and
sure,
we need to get out of here in about 15
taking
minutes.
So long.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So, basically, I would be against this bill, and thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you for coming here today. And Aaron Jarvis.
I have one question.
Okay, and I'm going to have Aaron Jarvis come up that wanted to make a comment, sir.
The new Lake Oswego Pier bridge, pier that's going in for Lake Oswego.
The dock, you mean?
The dock, yeah. How close is that to the Willamette Ramp?
Oh, it's quite a ways up.
Yeah, that's quite a ways up. That's probably a good,
I don't know,
7 river miles.
Yeah.
Okay. And if you can sit there, because I'll see if there's any other questions. Sir, you didn't sign up, but if you wanted to testify, you wanted to say something about the map. So could you state your name for the record, please?
Yeah, my name is Aaron Jarvis. I'm a Portland resident. I just drove down today in the middle of my work day to come discuss. Thank you for allowing me the time, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm with the Boaters Rights Coalition of Oregon, and our group formed, let me get this a little closer, our group formed about 3 years ago when the Marine Board started the Upper Willamette, the 15-mile stretch in the Upper Willamette, and that's when we kind of started our coalition. We're in position to try to protect boating as a whole, not power craft versus paddle craft. We want to try to keep the waterways safe for everybody, fun for everybody, and accessible for everybody. I sat on the ad hoc group board that was prior to the Holgate Channel Working Group. I was also a member of the working group. In my career path, I never thought I'd be sitting in a position here, but I am protecting my own boating rights and the 400 members that I represent with the Boaters Rights Coalition of Oregon. The Marine Board has gone through a position of, I don't think they really knew what to do. This has been controversial in Portland, as Trey mentioned on the phone. There's been 2 years of meetings, of trying to figure out what to do, the working group. This all started, when the original petitioners, petitioned to have the Holgate Channel and the Ross Island taken away. That was voted down in due process in July 2009. And The Marine Board retabled that later in October, and I'm just kind of giving you a little bit of history of what I've been doing with as a volunteer.
Yeah, and we have the history from the Marine Board. So do you have any comments on the bill or on that you want to share? Because we're running short on time.
I understand. I'm strongly opposed to the bill and the members that I support. You're essentially taking a user group out of scenario and giving it to another user group. I mean, that's what it basically comes down to. Now, the map itself, we've gone through a lot. We've talked about safety concerns. We've talked about border conflict. We've talked about environmental issues. There's a lot of different things. The Marine Board went through its processes. This thing has been drug out, and there's no real reason for it to be, put on this committee to decide. You know,
I'll ask you, are you supportive of the decision that came out of the Marine Board?
No, we're not supportive of the decision.
So you're
on the
not
Marine
supportive
Board.
Of any
well,
of the decisions?
We're not due to do compromise. The group that I support, had gone through this process and compromised. The ad hoc group, which I sat on, gave a compromise of giving up the Ross Island Lagoon. Then we went into a Holgate Channel working group discussion, which stalled. It was 12 committee members, 6 for, 6 against. We came out of those meeting processes, 6-6. The Marine Board has reviewed this information, this material, time and time again. We have compromised from a boating standpoint, but we sit here in front of you, this committee, now, still with no compromise from anybody on the other side. And you're taking boating away from a user group in the most populated area. I'll note on the map, on the western board of the southern tip of the map that you're looking at is the Wyoming Park. That is the busiest boat ramp, both paddle craft and powered craft, in the state. The busiest. One of the busiest.
Okay. So are there any questions from this panel? We're running out of time. We have a few more people that like to testify.
Okay.
Great. All right. Thank you very much for your time. We've got three more people, and then I'm going to call up the Marine Board Director. So Travis Williams, Dan Slover, is that right? Did I say that right? And Ron Kay. All right, thank you, gentlemen. We've just got a few minutes, so if you have written testimony, I'm going to ask if you can just summarize. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Travis Williams, and I'm a riverkeeper and executive director for Willamette Riverkeeper. My organization in particular works to protect water quality and habitat along the Willamette. Wakes and no-wake zones are not our primary reason for being, but in my work, I've spent a lot of time getting people on the water in the Portland area, literally thousands at this point, and over the years, we've noticed a very real issue along the Holgate Channel related to safety, and then several other issues that relate to environmental impacts of certain types of behavior and boating back in that area. We, along with the Audubon Society of Portland and the Urban Green Spaces Institute, were the original petitioner to create a no-wake zone along the entirety of the Holgate Channel and within Ross Island Lagoon. To date, we are very appreciative of the efforts of the Marine Board to take this issue seriously, along with their staff, and to work towards some resolution. To date, we are appreciative of the efforts that they have instituted to create a no-wake zone in the lagoon and for half of the channel. From our perspective, though, we should go and add the final piece. It's a very meaningful piece from the opening of the lagoon to the north part of the channel. One thing that we have to remember in all this, when people talk about their rights being taken away, I think the analogy related to traffic that Trey highlighted, there are rules. We do need rules in certain situations, and they're there for a very good reason, applies to this instance. There are 26.5 miles of main stem Willamette River that are tidally influenced from Willamette Falls down to the confluence of the Columbia. Even with popular boat ramps such as Willamette Park, there is plenty of room for those who seek to wakeboard, where essentially you're trying to generate massive wakes from your boat and ride them. You do not need a protected area to do that in. You have a wide river that is quite appropriate for that. In the example that we cite with Holgate Channel, you have a more restricted size channel.
You have an area that's adjacent to Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge. You have kind of a new natural area that the City of Portland acquired, was donated to City of Portland by Ross Island Sand and Gravel. So kind of a growing natural area. We believe that people ought to be able to go and paddle down Holgate Channel and see and hear the birds during the summertime or see mammals along the shoreline and not have conditions that are simply unsafe. No one is saying that boats cannot go into this area. You can take any sort of boat into this area with a no-wake zone. All it says is you can't generate a wake. My organization has a power boat. We use it periodically for a variety of purposes. We get a lot of people on the water in canoes and kayaks. Again, our belief with the growing number of canoeists and kayaks and rowers of all types in that area, it makes a lot of sense in this small area to designate it as a no-wake zone. So I'll leave it at that, and thank you.
Thank you, Travis.
My name is Dave Slover. I'm the owner of Alder Creek Kayak and Canoe in Portland, and thank you for letting me speak today.
Thanks for coming.
We put on, between ourselves and the other two commercial outfitters that are in the area, Willamette Park, Selwood Park, and the Portland Boathouse Ramp, about 5,000 canoes and kayaks, many of those with more than one person in them. And that's just the commercial estimate that I can't get my competitors to give me their exact numbers. But I'm making a pretty good guess, I think. And that has nothing to do with the private boaters, the people of the City of Portland and their friends and families that come and visit. Kayakers and canoeists like quiet, calm, peaceful, and if we can make the entire Holgate Channel no wake and cut down on the powerboat conflict, it's going to be great for the City of Portland and for canoeing and kayaking.
Thank you. Mr. Kay?
Hello, I'm Ron Kay. Thank you, Senator Dingfelder and committee members. I support Senate Bill 743. I'm a Dragon Sports USA volunteer. We have 36 Dragon Boat teams of approximately 22 paddlers, a minimum of 22 paddlers, and 16 outrigger teams of six persons. Over the more than the last 50 years, I've been rowing and paddling on the Willamette River. I've also been a U.S. Dragon Boat coach at the World Dragon Boat Championships in Australia. And currently, I'm a paddler, coach, caller, steerer, and an instructor. I participated in the 2 years of the ad hoc group and the Marine Board working group. And rather than reiterate other things that people have said, one of the things that the Marine Board had put in was the request for consider exempting safety launches while accompanying in an organized rowing or paddling race, program, club, or school. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for this gentleman?
Mm-hmm. Travis, there's in the Multnomah Channel, there's miles of no wake zone in front of houseboats. Miles of it. Why can't you go there and canoe?
I think it has to do with the proximity of that area to where people are, in addition to the aesthetics of the area. I think that with the facilities that we have around Ross Island and Holgate Channel and the sheer amount of people in that area who are interested in paddle sports, the equation's just different. We have the Portland Boathouse just about a mile and a half from Holgate Channel. You have Portland Kayak Company. You have Alder Creek Kayak and Canoe. You have Wasabi Paddlers. You have Rose City Rowing. You have University of Portland Rowing. You have Portland State Rowing. We have Selwood Riverfront Park. Where a lot of
people.
Yeah, so I think that really is the thing that makes this different.
Okay, one follow-up, please.
Sure.
Since the Marine Board, and I brought this up to Trey, since the Marine Board spent so much time, effort, and money on coming to a resolution, and they did, and now it's not satisfactory, you determine that this board should overturn their decision. Why can't we just take it back to the Marine Board and work out a more equitable use of the waterway? Instead of a law.
Yeah, I after 2 years of work with the Marine Board to establish a no-wake zone in this area, we're very appreciative with what they did and what they were able to accomplish in the amount of time. No, we do like it. What my belief is, my organization's belief, and I think others shared, is we just need to add the final component to this, and I think this forum is the forum to be able to get that done.
Comment, and the fact is you don't like it because you want that extra piece. You're not satisfied with what they gave you.
Okay, we're not going to have a huge debate here. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And, Bob, you have 1 minute if you wanted to come up and add anything that hasn't been said already. I know this is hard, but
I'll be briefer than that. I just wanted to put Audubon on the record as supporting it as well.
Okay, and can you say your name
again? My name is Bob Salinger, Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland, and everything we would say has already been said.
Okay, and so, did you want to add anything about wildlife?
Only that I think it is a very unique.
I know you wanted to testify. I still want to have the director up, but I want to make sure
you get to.
Yes,
It is a unique wildlife resource in the center of Portland. It's a place where a huge number of people can go and appreciate nature and spectacular nature very, very close to home. There's nothing else like it in most cities anywhere, and I think preserving it for that value is really critical. It creates a unique opportunity where people can literally walk out, put their canoe in the water, and go out and see these things that you can't see in most North American cities, and the speed and the noise and associated with high speed activity really precludes that. It's not a matter of compromising, because sometimes when you compromise, you exclude one half of the equation anyhow, and I think that's what's happening increasingly with the non-motorized paddlers because of the safety and because of the loss of experience.
Okay.
So
great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. All right, I wanted to have the director to come up. And thank you for your written testimony, Director, and I wanted to come up to see if there was any questions first, and then I had a question for you, so I'll see if there's any questions, remaining questions before I start losing members for the Director. I think my Vice Chair has a question for you.
Are you satisfied with the compromise?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, for the record, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board, that we reached as the Marine Board.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a Marine Board decision.
It was a very difficult decision. I think it was a decision that pitted two boating groups against one another, motorized and non-motorized, which from our perspective we don't like to do. We want the waterway to be open for everybody to be able to utilize, and having to deal with this type of controversy is very difficult, and I think it was difficult for the board members. It was a 3-2 vote that got us to where the southern end of the channel was at as a slow no-wake zone. So that did make it very difficult, I think, for them to really think about, is this an area that you want to shut off an activity? We didn't shut off boats because it is slow, no wake, so anybody can go into there, but we essentially shut down activities that are available in that area. Given all of the circumstances surrounding it in my full 11 months of being there, I would say that we reached the best decision we could given the circumstances.
I'm sure this is a favorite issue you have to work on. Okay, I do have another question for you, Director. Since this has not gone into effect yet, and it goes into effect on May 25th, 2011, as you pointed out in your testimony, can you describe for the committee members how you're going to enforce that?
Well, we're working with Multnomah County Sheriff's Office to make sure that we have a plan for this summer to ensure enforcement. We do have signage going in for the lagoon. We're going to need to look at signage probably for the southern end of the Holgate Channel as well to ensure that folks know once they pass the lagoon entrance it is a slow no wake, as well as having buoys marking that area as well. We're taking that very seriously to ensure. As some of the testimony that came up already, we really haven't had a full season to really enforce in that area anyhow, so it's important this summer that we really have some strong enforcement. I also hope that we have auxiliary staff available as well to be down there. The auxiliary boats are very helpful to establish a presence where people see them there, and oftentimes they'll make sure they're obeying the rules when they see the auxiliary, so hopefully they'll be a good partner with us as well.
Any other questions for the director? Okay, I will make a comment Unless you want to add anything else?
I just wanted to add two pieces, and I think they've been brought up already. The first is in regard to the chase boats, the safety boats that follow the organized rowing groups. They do need to be exempted from this to be allowed. They do have a wake when they're following the groups, and they carry the safety gear for the rowers, and I would hate for that to be an issue, so to make sure that they're exempted. Also, a lot of the rowers are very quick, and they can go faster than 5 miles per hour, so I would recommend it be a slow no-wake zone rather than having a speed restriction, because manually powered boats can move along at a pretty good pace.
Okay, thank you. I did want to make a comment. First of all, I brought this bill forward many, many months ago before even there was a final decision made. As you probably know, this was pre-session filed, so I think it was put in the end of last year, and the final decision had not been made. Number one. Number two, I want to emphasize, as I'm sure you know and you've heard here, it's a very important resource for the city of Portland, the city that I represent. So I would like for you to come back after this season and provide a full report to this committee on how the Marine Board is enforcing the decision. The bill is not moving forward at this time, but if there continues to be, you know, conflict, struggles, we're not enforcing it in the way it was intended, then my guess is we may be back here revisiting it. So just wanted to put you on notice that we'll probably have you back after the summer season, and we'll have an interim committee where we'll have you reporting on that, and I think it'll be useful to hear how monitoring is done by the Marine Board, and I know that you'll be taking that very seriously.
Be happy to do that.
Great. Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 743. Do I need to carry over anything? I'm just going to announce once again that we are carrying over the work sessions for Senate Bill 83 and Senate Bill 805. With that, the committee is adjourned until next Tuesday.